Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Psychosocial Distancing Podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Daniel Chadbourne, and with me, as always, is Thomas Brooks.
Hello, hello.
So today we are continuing our little flex course mini session on conspiracy theories in psychology. And joining us today is Dr. Mikey Biddlestone, who's recently published a paper on conspiracy theory beliefs from an individual, relational, and collective self approach. And so we're going to be joining him today. Thank you. Well, he's going to be joining us today. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. Yeah. this virtual living room, I guess. So it's both of us joining each other. Yeah.
That's why I edit. So we normally tell our guests that we're pretty terrible at introducing people, obviously, at that introduction, that we would like them to, I guess, introduce themselves. That way we don't leave out anything relatively important about your background.
Sure, yeah. So I'm Dr. Mikey Biddlestone. I'm a researcher in the social psychology of conspiracy beliefs, basically. So I've had a focus on, as you mentioned, the different levels of self-representation and how they might explain why we're drawn to conspiracy theories. But I'm also interested more generally in kind of perceptions of the government, moral perceptions of political scandals, especially with a conspiratorial perspective on it. Definitely, yeah.
Fascinating.
Awesome. I feel like we should also mention that you are a freshly minted doctor.
Yeah, okay.
So congratulations.
Thank you so much. Yeah, didn't want to toot my own horn, but yeah.
That is definitely now, something to toot.
Okay, tooted. Yeah, I've just joined the social decision-making lab at Cambridge. Basically, yeah, new official doctor. So yeah, still celebrating.
That's so exciting. Congratulations.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Cheers.
So I guess my first question for you is, what got you interested in conspiracy beliefs, conspiratorial thinking? What about this topic did you look at and go, that is exactly for me, and I want to spend an egregious amount of time researching it?
Yeah, they're kind of endlessly interesting, right? Everyone agrees that conspiracy theories are all just, people can talk about them endlessly. I think on a personal level, I had a couple of friends that, I guess, fell down the rabbit hole in a way. And I could tell that I sort of had these maybe stereotypes of them, or yeah, views of them that were maybe like dismissive. And understanding where they were coming from, I think, was something that I really wanted to do. Because I could tell, you know, that I had these sort of, I guess you could call them prejudiced views of like, how could you believe that sort of sentiments? And on top of that, you know, I knew I was interested in social psychology, and it just, this kind of really fits with a social psychology perspective, you know, in terms of specifically with in terms of how groups fall into conspiracy theories, right? Because we tend to believe conspiracies that are specific about certain outgroups who are relevant to us, you know, based on a national level or like a societal level or something. So yeah, that's where that crossover happens. But mostly, yeah, to understand some friends that I feel like fell down the rabbit hole, and it's on and off basically friendships because of that. But yeah, endlessly interesting as well.
I feel like that's something, I guess this may be a feature of 2021, but constantly having to balance relationships where differing beliefs and differing levels of conspiratorial thinking are involved. That's kind of factor that one has to calculate constantly with our social relationships right now.
No, absolutely. Yeah. I think it's kind of a moral thing, right? Because with COVID you have, well, someone who is, you know, maybe not vaccine hesitant, maybe just kind of fully is on board with the official narrative, so to speak, like it kind of makes you see someone who doesn't believe in those things as a sort of, there's a moral imperative there to persuade them, right? Because they could lead to deaths essentially. And that's sort of the reason why it feels important to us. That's how my reading of it, I don't know about you guys, but yeah, I feel like that's where I have to hold myself back, you know, and say, okay, but am I really persuading this person? Because the reason I feel so strongly about it is because I think they could lead to harm to others or something, you know?
Mm-hmm. At what point are you helpful, and what point are you just recreating Christian missionaryism?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly what you hated in the first place. Yeah.
Yeah, I got this. I remember listening to, it was one of the NPR. This was way pre. I mean, we're talking How long ago was this? 5-6 years ago at this point, was talking about kind of the nature. And I think that was sort of at the beginning of kind of where I was, and I don't study it, but I am very interested in kind of understanding what brings someone to that rabbit hole, what has them fall in, what has them sort of latch on. And one of the things that really, I guess I picked up on early on with some early social psych research on just the nature of predominantly parents who were against like the MMR vaccine and who were kind of like leading into a lot of these odd narratives and misinformation concerning it. And they ultimately found that like at the core was fear for their kids. And as a new parent at the time, when I was starting to, you know, listen to that, I was like, no, I get it. I'm irrationally afraid of stuff happening to my kid. Mm-hmm. I guess I can understand like where that's coming from. And they were looking at how to address that fear to kind of, you know, get into, you know, the you have to address that underlying motive of the individual in that situation.
Exactly. No, the motive element of that is what I've focused on in the past few years is so the kind of general perspective that's used the most at the moment. This is quite an early research area, so I should mention that, you know, a lot of the theories or the theoretical frameworks are kind of descriptive as opposed to pitting them against each other yet. You know, we're still kind of uncovering how these processes relate to each other. But the kind of, yeah, the accepted approach that seems to be gaining a lot of traction is that basically conspiracy beliefs stem from frustration of basic psychological needs, right? So these are kind of three main types of needs. So the sort of underlying one is sort of what you mentioned to do with fear. It's based on, you know, existential threats. So these can be existential threats from the world around us, such as climate change or COVID-19. And in order to kind of regain a sense of understanding or control and security of your environment, conspiracy theories can offer this kind of simple narrative that allows you to, I guess, control and predict the world around you and make sense of it when realistically, you know, there's a lot of things that maybe we'll just never know. That's very difficult for humans to accept. On top of that, there's also these epistemic concerns in order to gain certainty and how you kind of process information, which is a bit more cold psychology, you know, that's more about, yeah, thinking and processing styles. And then finally, you have like the social elements, which are things like defending the image of yourself and the groups that you belong to. That's kind of the intergroup aspect of it, alongside kind of these interpersonal relationship elements as well, which is actually quite understudied at the moment, in terms of there's a bit of research showing that, you know, when you experimentally manipulate feelings of social exclusion, that people will turn to conspiracy theories probably in order to maybe regain social support or kind of make interpersonal relationships based on shared epistemic concerns, things like that, or ideological concerns, things like this. But what hasn't really been focused on that much is the resulting social exclusion that people have when they believe in conspiracy theories, and how there's this maybe kind of endless cycle there that as you feel social exclusion, you turn to conspiracy theories. As you believe in conspiracy theories, you get excluded again. So it kind of is that sort of it isolates people right into these smaller and smaller groups, maybe, yeah, from society. And that's sort of what we touched on in that paper that you brought up as well, which is how kind of on the within the social motives, right, there's this individual level, which is about how to perceive yourself and differentiate yourself from other individuals, or kind of enhance your image of yourself, or defend the image of yourself. So that's kind of where the conspiratorial element comes from. If I want to defend myself image, I'm going to accuse everyone else as being responsible for any of my shortcomings, something like that. And the relational element is that social exclusion I mentioned, or the collective level, which is these groups that we belong to, and defending those images and how we maybe perceive the in-group as particularly victimized, which can also, you know, justify these moral perceptions of the world that you're discriminated against by conspiratorial out-groups, things like that as well. Sort of a crash course of the framework that we put in there.
Yeah.
So I guess since we have the big picture, moving backwards, I guess, and then we taking it step by step, if we start with the existential motives, like you discussed, what is this, I guess, alienation or vulnerability that, is this kind of like a catalyst, or are people, can these be like legitimate alienations, or does it just need to be the feeling of alienation or a lack of meaning? Where do we draw the line there between like the perception and say the reality?
Well, it's actually very hard to. I think that's a really good question because, you know, when I talk to people who are not psychology researchers, but they research other things, a lot of the thing, the kind of impression I get is that they're often asking about, are these feelings based in reality? And that's quite hard to capture when what we know is that this feeling leads to conspiracy beliefs, right? But as you're saying, you know, for example, I could genuinely be experiencing societal deprivation as a minority or a disadvantaged person, in which case those feelings of alienation are a representation of reality. However, if they're leading to these perceptions where you're kind of retrofitting or top-down processing everything as a conspiratorial plot, that's still really harming to you and you, those around you, harmful, sorry, to you and those around you, which can have, you know, detrimental consequences. That essentially means that even though you can't really dismiss those feelings, you need to put them in context and say, okay, these feelings are valid. However, they're not necessarily relevant to every single circumstance that happens around you. And what we often find is that disadvantaged groups do tend to display stronger beliefs in conspiracy theories or conspiracy plots. And it's kind of what you're getting at there is that, yeah, they've genuinely experienced disproportionate amounts of, yeah, conspiratorial plots against them or discrimination, which can take the form of conspiracy theories. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, those are hard to tease apart, basically.
Right. And then to determine when the it's just conspiratorial thinking and when there actually is a conspiracy as well. Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking of like the Tuskegee experiments, for example.
Exactly. That's always the one that comes to my mind as well. I mean, so there is some very recent work on how to kind of distinguish between this sort of element of, I guess, irrational kind of obsession with these beliefs, right, and perceiving the whole world in the same way, or what, you know, what you're describing is rational skepticism that leads to uncovering genuine conspiracies, right? And I think it is quite difficult to tease apart, but one of the things they have found is that there is definitely this difference where most people will believe in or be suspicious of one event to the point where maybe they'll say, yeah, I can see how that conspiracy theory would be true. And that tends to be stuff like that sort of transcends group dynamics. So things like, you know, the Epstein didn't kill himself one, that could be palatable to both, you know, people on the both partisan sides or people in different groups, you know, that kind of thing in many different ways. So it's kind of appealing to everyone. And there's also, you know, an understandable element to that where there's a real lack of information there. So people fill that information with their ideas, right? That lack of that vacuum, right? They fill the vacuum with their ideas. That being said, on the other side, there is this measurable thing in psychology, which we refer to at the moment, conspiracy mentality is what we call it. And it's basically, you know, you don't just believe in one, you believe in basically all conspiracy theories, bar maybe extraterrestrial ones for some reason. We're not quite sure why yet, but extraterrestrial ones seem to still not be necessarily palatable to people with a conspiracy mentality. The idea being that instead of, you know, maybe I believe one specific conspiracy theory because, as I mentioned, I don't know, appeals to you specifically in that one way, right? People with a conspiracy mentality probably have a mixture of these thwarted or frustrated psychological needs all interacting at once, right? So there's just this chaotic compensation by just believing in these theories, because otherwise you'd have to address so many of these feelings, right? To dismantle it and, yeah, to understand it properly.
Yeah, I, kind of going back to what you had said and at the sort of beginning of this, that there's... And especially when looking at that existential side, like we like to approach it and have this discussion like, well, but this isn't reality. But like for this individual, if they're experiencing that fear, if they're experiencing that existential dread or that kind of is their reality, yeah. That it becomes, mm-hmm. you know, and their way of looking at the world. And I mean, I can kind of see like, well, I'll take UFOs. We have a paper and we're rolling the dice on it because it's such an odd topic that like not a whole lot of people want to pick this up. But we can definitely see that for some people in the community, there is that sense where they're not looking at it as a conspiracy. They're definitely looking at it as sort of rational skepticism. These are things that the Navy has seen. These are things that we have video of. We just don't know what they are. We're not saying that they're aliens. Okay. There's a whole nother, you know, side of that. But there are definitely people within a lot of these communities that are kind of checking all these boxes, that there's this sense of, it's a big world. I don't understand everything. could be aliens, could be something else.
Why not?
Why not? Right. Yeah. And then there's also like it adds into other conspiracy theories. So if you already have kind of a distrust of the government, well, you're not going to believe the government when they say like, oh, of course there's no aliens. It's just a drone. You'd be like, no, I don't believe them. I think they're hiding something. Mm-hmm. And so like there's that, you know, again, the uncertainty that builds up and like a lot of these motives kind of all intertwine. And then it's a community to join. I could see the social motives there when we're looking at these groups where you join this community and you're kind of interested, but the more and more you interact with the community and they're very different. There's like three or four of the Reddit communities and they're very different in a number of ways. Some are a little more rational in their sort of systematic review. Some of them a little more hypothetical, I guess would be the best way to put it in terms of how they approach some of these topics. And you can kind of see some of these person to person, almost these different motives playing out and how they talk about
which subreddits are those out of interest, because I've looked at a few, but
I looked at UFO believers, are UFOs, are UAP, and that's the branch off group when the government came out and said we're going to call them unidentified aerial phenomenon. That group tends to look at things from a much more evidence-based approach and tends to discourage a lot of like, here's this thing we saw on a shaky cam. And they're like, we can't really do anything with this, but we'll look at the Navy footage and we'll try to break that down, you know, versus the other groups that are like, here's this guy who wrote a book about alien abduction.
Well, that thing that you mentioned about the community element, you know, that sounds like they've got their own norms, you know, as a social identity, which is so interesting to me, you know, that they're like, no, we're you could call us maybe possible believers in extraterrestrial stuff, but we're not like those guys. We're like, you know, we have our own approach. And that distinction, I think, is quite prevalent in conspiracy communities, you know, because they've got to distinguish themselves from others. I mean, actually, in an individual sense, we call that a need for uniqueness. That's a lot very highly correlated with conspiracy beliefs, is this need to express the fact that, I mean, all conspiracy theories basically say I'm holding secret knowledge, right? So people can say they're very special for knowing that kind of thing. So yeah, I think that's part of it as well, especially with UFOs, of course, because it's that secret knowledge, isn't it?
Yeah, I learned the phrase the extraterrestrial hypothesis, and that's people who are like, there are no aliens, or we can't say that they're aliens, and we don't talk about the ET hypothesis, versus the people who are like, yeah, let's talk about aliens.
I mean, we all know why we're here, guys. Yeah.
Right.
I mean, we don't believe it, wink, wink, but... But that's, I think part of it, like recently there's this paper, Jan-Willem van Pruwen has done some recent stuff on the entertainment value of conspiracy theories. I don't know if you've seen this, but like essentially what he's saying is that they serve this thing like how we watch horror movies, you know, we get excitement out of watching action movies or something that kind of, there's like an adventure element to things, you know, where you're finding clues and you're doing this kind of detective work as well. So it makes total sense that excitement and that interest comes from the fact that they are just, they're stories, right? They're interesting, sort of fun stories.
The sociological literature takes it kind of a bottom-up approach in this case, and maybe it would be where the stories start, and the stories have influenced entertainment, and the entertainment has then led to that higher belief or interest in like UFOs and aliens from that standpoint. And so there's probably this odd interact, because I really wish I would have gone through the conspiracy theory research on this paper, because I could have added that to what we were talking about. Because there's a very strong argument that our entertainment and what we're engrossed in because of that popularity, and that I think ties into your social sense, is that if you're around your group of friends and you're talking about the latest alien movie, you're talking about space exploration or something like that, that's going to build that interest. Yeah. And then that might lead you down that rabbit hole at some point.
It's kind of validating, right? I mean, you talk about those communities, and I think maybe the gateway is, these are interesting, let's just, I don't know, indulge my interest. Then what you're doing is you're constantly interacting with these people who just validate the beliefs as a representation of reality, which can probably change your perspective of stuff. I should say that's kind of speculative, but it seems to be how it works, right? How you get sucked into these communities or something.
One of the things that Daniel and I study is the fandom aspect of social psychology. And so that need for belonging, that sense of community, what happens when you don't necessarily have that outside like within your like family, community, school, work structure, and then how do fandoms supplement that need to belong? And so I'm thinking that some of these conspiracies maybe take on a new life as opposed to if we were studying them in the 20th century. You know, it's not your uncle in the basement, like, you know, putting wires and papers up on the walls going, the government's watching me. And now it's like, oh, hey, I'm a part of this community. I went to this cool convention. I've got new friends that we get on Zoom with. And so there's like this deeper, particularly, I guess you could say, even within the context of COVID-19 during like lockdowns, for example, if you've been isolated away from your community and now you have a new community online, that makes the conspiracy theory way more digestible.
No, of course. And something to do, right? Just in the first place. I mean, I think there's some very, like, you know, I think it was one paper where they measured it, but they did find that, you know, feelings of boredom lead to conspiracy beliefs as well. Of course, we've got that stuff about entertainment value. But yeah, what you're mentioning, I guess, is that the societal circumstances really like create a hotbed for that to really take place, right? For, yeah, for your interest in conspiracy theories to become everything at that moment. I'm not doing anything else, so I might as well log on to the conspiracy subreddit again and see what they're talking about. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, it's chemtrails again. Cool. Yeah.
There's the one of the other things that we look at besides like entertainment value and belonging is a sense of purpose and meaning through your your fan community, and it definitely I think corresponds with the idea of wanting that secret information, wanting to feel more important because you're in the know, and that in a sense can give you a sense of meaning if you're feeling lacking in that in some ways, or purpose. I have to drive, I have to shout this from the mountaintops and proselytize my conspiracy theory belief to the world, because that's everyone needs to know this is serious
most
stuff.
Important thing, right? Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah, that's actually, you know, my experience with talking to people, as I mentioned, there's friends and stuff, like a lot of our it doesn't tend to happen now because we know that all we're trying to do is just shout at this wall where we're both very decided in our views. But, you know, I realized that there was this like need to inform me, that this guy needed to inform me that, you know, the world is basically run by this small cabal of people who are lying to us about the vaccines and all that stuff. And like, I can understand why that's such a strong feeling. You know, he's uncovered the biggest secret that's ever happened in his perception. You know, how could you not want to just tell everyone, and the people that you care about especially? You know, it's like sad for them probably that no one's listening to them and we're all about to die. You know, that must be really terrifying. But yeah, but of course we don't listen because we all set in our ways as well, aren't we, all of us?
No, it seems like it's the same psychological experience both ways, on the behalf of the conspiracy theorist and the person who is, you know, advocating the vaccine. I know this important thing that you have to do, otherwise you're going to die.
Exactly. And that's why, you know, I was really checking my prejudice on these things, right? Because I knew that it became clear to me that, like, you know, I was still confident in my views, but I was still using similar arguments to him. So really, neither of us were persuading each other. We're both in the same boat as you're describing, you know, and that was something that really made me step back and go, okay, maybe I should not become someone who, you know, if someone's whole life is encompassed by believing in conspiracy theories, maybe you can become someone whose life is encompassed by being anti-conspiracy theory, you know? And I don't want to do that. That's not what I'm interested in, you know? I'm interested in understanding it, but not necessarily fighting it, you know? It's not, yeah, it would be a long battle as well doing that, but yeah.
We spoke with, our opening episode for this Flex course was with a historian, and we were like, where do conspiracy theories come from? And he laughed at us. He's like, they've always been here. They will always be here.
That sounds intense.
some percentage. We're specifically talking about it from like American history. There's just some percentage of Americans who have always believed that there's just some conspiracy going on, that there's some underlying, whether or not it holds true, but it you know, becomes their reality. It becomes their understanding of how the world works, and the difficult hill to you know, climb up against.
Definitely. I mean, actually, I think, you know, I think America gets a bad rap in a way, a bit unfairly, in the sense that as if it's the only nation where certain processes happen, right? But I think there is an interesting thing about the birth of the US in terms of the Constitution and stuff, where it's kind of based on this anti-government sentiment, right? This or need to protect yourself from the government, which in itself is like what the conspiracy mentality is, right? Is we need to watch out for these nefarious people who are going to be doing stuff behind closed doors. I mean, it's kind of almost written into the Constitution in a way. But understandably, you know, it makes sense from the context of how it all happened, right?
But, and yeah, it's unfortunate. Dr. Ritter talked about that very, very openly. Like, nope, we literally have the conspiratorial belief written in our Constitution.
There you go, yeah.
Which ironically, you know, 200 plus years later, we have people who are like, the government, the same kind of arguments, the same sort of beliefs that's going on.
No, definitely. And actually, I think that kind of brings up the system justification thing, right? Because I think the need to challenge the system, right? So there's system challenging beliefs or there's system justifying beliefs. And so one side, you want to defend the status quo. The other side, you want to challenge the status quo. I think there's merits and sort of excess to both, right? Because if I'm just, I mean, I find myself unnecessarily system challenging in a way, you know, where I just sort of, if the government does something good, I'm like, yeah, but what's behind it, you know? Or and that's not to say that I'm not correct, but the point is that I'm just constantly doing that. I'm obviously motivated to maybe in a extreme way just challenge that narrative, which can lead to conspiracy beliefs down the line, you know, so you gotta watch that. And yeah, but there's actually some stuff I've been doing recently where so there's kind of these mixed findings where intuitively I think it should be that beliefs that challenge the system are correlated with conspiracy beliefs, because of course you're seeing the government or authority as this nefarious presence that you think that you need to change these power structures in order to stop that from happening, right? But we don't necessarily find that. It's quite mixed findings sometimes. So what I tried to do was maybe tease these things apart. So there's this recent focus on different types of conspiracy theories that either target minority groups or less powerful groups versus powerful groups. So the idea there is that, like, I can believe in a conspiracy theory that still defends the status quo, because what I'm saying is, for example, my country is amazing. Anything bad that's happening is this small group of people that are invading the country secretly, right? And it's usually takes the form of like Islamophobic conspiracy theories, right? That they're kind of these kind of like Islamist fundamentalists are changing society from within, and they're going to create Sharia law or something, right? That could be very system supporting, right? Or system justifying, because that's saying my nation is amazing, everyone else is bad. But what tends to be, I think, the majority of conspiracy theories is what you could call maybe anti-establishment conspiracy beliefs, which is that, yeah, you want to challenge the system because they are the ones who realistically do have the powerful means to orchestrate some sort of real conspiracy. Whereas I think it's slightly less realistic to assume that this minority or marginalized group is going to be able to, yeah, organize a conspiracy, right? It seems less realistic to me.
That makes sense to me, but here I could definitely see that, like thinking about it as you're talking, of this nature of like the system is there. Like, we have this, the American government is good, you know, America is great, but the people, it may be a small group, but they're always portrayed as very influential groups. So whether or not you have this sort of Illuminati organization or Hollywood, it's always been a big thing with in terms of like the target, you know, these liberal Hollywood elites that are doing all of this stuff behind closed doors. They're the ones who are ruining things, and they're putting people in power. And if we can get them out of power, we can get the right people in power. And so that perpetuates that positive government view or that positive view, but it has to be the right. It has to be our guys, which is a very, again, it kind of ties into that social strata.
As you were mentioning that, yeah, it kind of reminded me of some work I've done on collective narcissism, which is this like type of identification with your in-group that's based on this idea that you believe that your group doesn't receive the recognition that it deserves. So it's this kind of like narcissistic approach to identification, right? My group is amazing. But it's kind of linked to like vulnerable narcissism as well. So it's sort of low self-esteem. So maybe you kind of compensate for that by saying my group's amazing, everyone else is just trying to bring us down, that kind of thing. And I think what we're seeming to find again in these like recent studies is there's this need to kind of distinguish the real and fake people in my group, right? The people who are really on our side, who they get it, you know, they're the right people, and the people who are just there to, I don't know, they could be seen as a conspiracy from within even, you know, sometimes, which is an interesting distinction there.
I wonder, this was kind of teased a little bit in your articles, but this idea that low status groups are more likely to have conspiracy theories. Do those conspiracy theories always take the form of outgroups, or do they happen within the group as well? Like, will the conspiracy theorists eat their young?
Yeah, so this is actually some recent stuff that I've been doing is So what we've tended to find historically, right, is that collective narcissism, this defensive in-group identity, is linked to beliefs about conspiracy theories about out-groups, but not about your in-group, right? So the idea there is that it's this intergroup process where your group is amazing, everyone else is bad. However, recently what they've done is sort of found that actually when you measure it, so let's say I have collective narcissism with my nation, but then they ask you about whether you believe conspiracies about your own government, you're sometimes willing to believe those conspiracy theories, right? Even though you identify very strongly and kind of insecurely in a collective narcissism sense with your national identity, you still believe, understandably, that your government might conspire against you. And the idea there is that maybe it's not about conspiracy theories about outgroups, but it's more about just perceiving the world in terms of group-based conspiracies. So you believe that there are these, you can basically subtype your in-group, right? So even though I believe you're the same national identity as me and I identify with you in that sense, suddenly you bring up the salient identity trigger of being in the government or an authority. Now I'm distinguishing you from myself, right? So there's this kind of endless distinction that you can make there that, you know, you're always doing that. But the point is that I think collective narcissists engage in that more so than others, right? That's the point. They are distinguishing more so than other people are within their group or out of their group. So to answer your question, I think it's can be conspiracies from within, but maybe they are kind of seeing their in-group as not typical, or they're subtyping their own in-group to say that now they're a person who's going to be bad against me or conspire against me.
Right. It's kind of like the distinctions between the differing levels of UFO alien believers. Exactly. Like, we would, from the outside, homogenize them as all one group, but within the group, they're just very interested in distinguishing themselves from each other. But within the conspiracy framework, then, of subtyping in groups, like, you could say, oh, they're Americans, they're a conspiracy theorist, but reality, there's like, no, I'm the good American versus this one.
Yeah, exactly.
Kind of the opposite of, like, when you increase, like, broader group salience, so American versus like state level or group level or world, you know, human versus American, we tend to see like that higher level of inclusiveness, that higher level of like, this is kind of reversing that. Like, I'm an American, they're like, but what about the government? Like, whoa, no, I'm a common guy, I'm not one of those elites. So, and then that kind of reduces it, and then it reduces it, and then you start fracturing because you want that higher sense of uniqueness. So if you're a flat earther, are you a, you know, standard flat earther, are you a firmament believer, are you a number of different subcategories, like, where's your kind of subset of niche knowledge that further almost alienates everyone else, but kind of restricts that group sense.
I think there's a really interesting kind of like intellectual point there as well. You know, like, I've got a couple of friends who are like, you know, I would describe as, you know, quite left-wing, like very left-wing, you know, and they've got these terms for how to describe their ideology, you know, and they kind of put, and I don't know enough about the history of, you know, left-wing ideology. I know that I've got left-wing beliefs, but, you know, I don't tend to call myself a somethingist-ite and all that kind of thing, right? But they've got these like different names for stuff, and that to me is kind of what you're getting at there, which is this like distinction, but it's based on an education, right? It's like that they're interested in that, so they've educated themselves about what these things are called. But what they're doing is like really exacerbating the stereotype of the left wing again, is that it eats itself, you know, like infighting and that kind of thing, which can be an issue with winning elections and that kind of thing. You know, whether you think that that's the be all and end all, of course, is a different question. But the point being that, yeah, I'm not sure how helpful it is to make these distinctions, right? And if on that level, you know, if conspiracy theorists maybe were more likely to band together as one collective identity, as opposed to this infighting that you're describing, right, of creating this uniqueness, maybe they, you know, they would get a lot more support, you know, create this more transcendent collective identity, as opposed to, yeah, no, I'm a flat earther, but I'm not a, yeah, blah, 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 you know.
So to all our conspiracy theorists listening, social psychology.
No. Yeah, shit, cut this one out, actually. I got a 3-step plan for you, okay? Yeah. You infiltrate the government.
I mean, that was my impression as an undergraduate when I took my first social psych class. I was like, this knowledge is dangerous. Yes, like, I was like, you just have to be in the right position to know all these things. Mm-hmm, I was just blown away when I took my first course, and I was like, oh man.
Yeah.
If you were the wrong kind of person.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
This is a toolbox.
We definitely see examples of that, of individuals who kind of like rise to prominence amongst some of these conspiracy theory groups, and who are able to kind of capitalize on a number, kind of like bring a number of the kind of different conspiracy theories under one umbrella. I mean, I think of someone like Andrew Wakefield as maybe a good example of someone who's kind of at least helped add some credence. So there are, I think, people, at least to my knowledge of the anti-vax community, the people kind of within his sphere that are maybe, you know, using him at conventions and stuff to kind of further that larger umbrella. But if you can get someone who's maybe bringing five or six different kind of sub categories of this particular belief, that you can, you're building it, you're increasing that umbrella. Yeah,
definitely. And actually I'm really interested in this topic, right? So kind of what you described there, I think pre-COVID I saw this term, or someone told me this term that they use in the literature sometimes, which is a conspiracy entrepreneur, right? Which is someone that's making money from pushing these conspiracy theories. Now, I think, you know, there's lots of different names for them in the literature, but, you know, we can call them merchants of doubt, or just basically pushing disinformation online, right? And that's, of course, disinformation is different from misinformation in that it's like purposefully spread for sometimes, you know, some political reason, or essentially, you know, generally we can call them grifters. That is really interesting to me, because what we're doing there is we're saying they have nefarious intentions, and what they're doing is colluding in order to make lots of money by spreading conspiracy theories. So essentially they are conspiring to spread conspiracy theories, and that's a meta conspiracy theory in itself. And like, I know that's a very, you know, that's an endless conversation that you can have, but I think this is one of the really interesting areas that's not really been tapped into massively yet. It's been, someone's got scale that kind of covers this idea that conspiracy theories, the term conspiracy theorist or conspiracy theory was made up by the CIA in order to delegitimize any concerns or challenges to power, right? And it's just endless in the a conspiracy theory conspiracy or something like that.
And I know that there's one about like how like alien movies and like our discussion of that is to just prepare us for the fact that aliens exist. Like there's this whole conspiracy theory about that, but that's really fascinating to me. I think that's what, and maybe now that there's a scale for it, maybe I'll start delving into this, because I've always been really interested in trying to sort of suss out, is this person a true believer or are they a grifter? And it's really hard to tell with some of them. It's really easy to tell with some people that you're like, nope, this person believes everything that they're saying. They're all in. But every now and then you come across someone and you're like, are they just, you know, did they take that social psych class and then they're putting two and two together and they're like, I get it. Like, I can do this. I can lead people to that, but I don't have to believe any of it.
Exactly. Yeah. They're just Thomas 2 years on, basically. It's using that social psych information. Yeah. There's actually, so I don't know how much you guys know about. So in the UK, you know, of course, we have the whole anti-vaccine movement. It's similar to in the US kind of thing. But I think there are distinctions. You know, there's certain celebrities that tend to, you know, push themselves in the UK, not in the US, and vice versa. There's this really famous one, Piers Corbyn, who is very anti-vax, right? Yeah, yeah. That's a recognizing noise there.
He is notorious here too.
Okay, so it's not just the UK. Okay, that's good to know then. So yeah, this all makes sense to people. But I don't know how many people saw this, but it seemed to only be really big for like just over maybe 24 hours on Twitter, right? This guy did a prank on Piers Corbyn. Did you guys see this? Okay, so he organized, I want to get this right because it's important, I guess, to see what sides. So this guy organized a fake meeting with Piers. Sorry, the meeting was real, but under false pretenses that they were going to agree on. They said that they were from Pfizer and that they wanted Piers Corbyn to lay off criticizing Pfizer vaccines and only keep criticizing the other vaccines, right? There was this conversation that they filmed between them where Piers Corbyn accepted money for this, and there was this like ambiguous acceptance where I think he knew probably not to say yes, I will do this in order to not bring up Pfizer, but he was accepting money 100%, accepting that cash. When he, like, basically what they did was they gave him Monopoly money, so it was in a suitcase, I think. And before, I think as this video was being released, I think Piers Corbyn preemptively made this video where he was talking to camera, where he was saying he got completely scammed by these people and that they're conspiring against him and that they may possibly bring out a video that makes him look bad and stuff. Don't believe the bullshit, all that kind of thing, right? So this was this really interesting example where they really effectively exposed his griftiness, you know, and it just didn't really stick, you know. And I wanted that to be something that was shared in conspiracy theorist communities or anti-vax communities, for them to see what their response is to that, because they can always update their conspiracy, right? And I saw a few people saying stuff like, this is just fake, right? But that was all they had. All they could say was, this is a fake video, and that was it. There was no like looking at the detail or anything like that. And I don't know, if I'd hope that people listening to this would watch that video and just see the griftiness that he has in him. It's
I'll go and find it and I will link it.
Yes, it's central to this chat that we're having.
It reminds me of that was it Sacha Baron Cohen did that whole series where like he got like went into like the deepest rabbit holes, but also with like actual government officials or people associated with the government, and got them to sort of agree to all sorts of stuff. And it really kind of calls into like, okay, how much are they really behind what they're saying versus how much is this just like, if it can make me a buck, I'm good.
Yeah, it's honestly, it's the big grift at the moment. It's a really effective grift. Just rely on any kind of pseudoscience or that spirituality stuff as well, right? I don't mean to be, you know, dismissive again, but yeah, people believing that those kind of the rocks and that kind of thing. I think it falls into a similar thing. It's sometimes referred to as like conspirituality and that kind of thing. And like they cross over and it's not as problematic, I guess, other than that you can be maybe grifted on. But that's about it, really, yeah.
I also wonder to like what is the level of I don't know, spectacle that goes into all of this as well, or like this consumption of the conspiracy. So like with this Pierce video or even the Sacha Baron Cohen, like how much is that like in of itself a justification for conspiracy theories to rethink what they're doing, versus like you were saying, Mikey, about like, am I being the conspiracy theorist, like anti-conspiracy theorist? Like, is this just for me to consume? Am I the target audience here? For me to laugh at other people?
And I think that's honestly like a big question for the era that we're in right now, which is that whether people are with you or they're against you, they're clicking on your video or they're watching, they're giving you views, right? And I find this with people who are these kinds of, I think they call themselves like intellectual dark web or something, right? Is that people like, for example, Jordan Peterson, right? Very divisive figure. If people hate him, they'll watch his video. And if people love him, they'll watch his video. And he's like broken the algorithm in that way. And I don't think that's specific to him, but you know, as an example, I think there's a lot of them that manage to do that. It's kind of this controversial figure on purpose, right? And they're making money off of it either way.
Our obsession, or not maybe obsession, but our desire to sniff out the grifter or figure out who's authentic and who's inauthentic will then drive that view count.
Exactly, yeah.
So being ambiguous about your intentions or your authenticity then will then increase. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, that's a really good way to put it, I think. Yeah, it excites me anyway. I get interested in it. So unfortunately it gives them views sometimes.
I don't know if it's better. I tend to watch the people who watch them. And so I'll kind of watch it by proxy, but that in itself is this whole way to make money. And it sort of adds into this, like, all right, am I feeding this? Am I, and there's that conflict that builds up. Cause again, I don't want to, you know, be just another, you know, an anti-conspiracy theorist in terms of like that becoming such a strong, you know, identity. I want to focus on, but then again, maybe it's through the identity of wanting to be, I mean, I would maybe argue that this is kind of backpedal just a little bit. I could argue that this is an aspect of just, you know, human nature. There was, I forget their name because I'm terrible with that, but that's sort of like, we're all social scientists. We're all social psychologists to an extent. We all want to know what's going on in our environment. We all want to find an answer. Just some of us have that scientific methodology training, some of us don't. And so we stop at different points. And even those of us with training, if it's not something we're as versed in, we might stop at a particular point. I can't run an experiment on this. So I just have to kind of end at, you know, maybe someone I believe is an expert in that. Sure. And so it kind of, you know, we're all going through the same process. So whether our end result is maybe that conspiracy theory or not, we're kind of going through this kind of standard process of trying to understand the world and try to come to conclusions. It's just some of us, I guess, want to get, you know, we kind of look at like getting rid of that uncertainty early and accepting that first thing, or accepting that first page Google search or 10th page Google search versus, you know, a Google Scholar search or a, you know, deep dive into the literature.
No, definitely. And I think this is why, like, you know, the phrase like critical thinking gets thrown around a lot, right? But I think it's important to like understand the context behind that, because it's not just using these effective cognitive skills, right? It's like kind of trying to run against your motivated reasoning. So, you know, for example, you know, we find often that people with high cognitive abilities will still believe conspiracy theories. And it's because they're able to use these cognitive skills to justify the beliefs they already had or what they wanted to believe. And they're using these very effective skills to do that because they're motivated to believe what they already want to believe, right? So yeah, it can actually be linked to intelligence sometimes. It's just whether you're valuing your rational or reflective cognitive processing as opposed to this intuitive or automatic kind of satisfying, cognitive processes, satisfying in the short term, I should say, not necessarily the long term. Yeah, that kind of comfortability with ambiguity, I think, is something I feel a lot, that I think I have this preference for ambiguity in thinking, right, where I think I understand that people want, like, need for closure and things, but I love a movie that ends with an ambiguous ending, for example, and that might fall into my anti-conspiracy approach, you know, something like that.
No, absolutely. So we are nearing the hour mark, and I have a couple more questions. These are questions that we are asking all of our guests. The first one is, what is the environment around the conspiracy researchers? Where are the tensions? Where are the conflicts? So at the top of the hour, you talked about how we're still developing theories around conspiracy thinking and models, and we haven't tested them against each other yet. So where is the tension or the conflict within the research community on conspiracy thinking?
I think that's a good question, actually, because, as I said, you know, it's an early research topic. I think one of the biggest, I wouldn't necessarily say tensions, but I would say kind of disconnects, is between this research that I'm kind of going into at the moment, which is more applied. So it's more looking at how people can be protected against the persuasion attempts of disinformation online, right? Regardless of whether that's to do with conspiracy theories or whether that's about radicalization or whether that's about prejudice, misinformation, right? The idea being that it's more applied to that context as opposed to being reliant on the kind of psychological theory background. And then what I've come from just now with my PhD is this focus on the theoretical side and developing tools to kind of understand these psychological processes. I think it will happen very soon, but these two lines of thinking are quite disconnected at the moment. And I think they come to similar conclusions, or they come up with similar solutions to problems and say, we've not done that yet, when actually the other side has done that, and vice versa, you know? So really linking those two things together is a bit of a tension, I guess, and we need to do that. But that being said, you know, no one's resisting that. I think it's more of just a facet of new research areas, right? And figuring out where it sits. And basically so far, it's just been applying previous or existing psychological theories to the context of conspiracy beliefs, right? So extending that will be the new frontier, so to speak, you know, in the research area. That's what I'd say.
I've seen this when delving into, like, the UFO literature, at least what little there is in psychology, and I'm not sure if this is more, I guess, more widespread in that field than we might see in the conspiracy theory literature, but I don't really look at this as like a modern tension, but there seems to be this kind of disconnect in the way we used to look at things, and I'm not sure if we see more of a focus in the older literature on conspiracies on, like, psychopathology and more of, like, a clinical approach. Cause with, like, UFO stuff, it's just sort of like, well, these abductees are obviously this is their diagnosis. Whereas the more modern stuff really isn't even delving into that. It's mostly like sociology and other fields that are kind of trying to understand where our interest in those topics come from. And do you see anything like that with the conspiracy, like, where there seems to be, I guess, maybe is there a tension? Do you see any pushback on that regard, like, outside of social sites?
I guess that's a good point, actually. I think to be fair, people are accepting that the psychopathological, like, explanation or whatever is not enough. So, you know, of course, people who have maybe delusions of grandeur or something tend to be paranoid. They tend to see conspiracies in places, as an example. But that doesn't mean that that's the only way, you know, that people believe conspiracies. And we kind of accept now that these are group processes that can be capitalized on by, I don't know, governments or groups or, like, grifters, as we were saying, you know. So basically we're all susceptible to conspiracy theories, suggesting that it's not about, you know, this pathological element of things. That being said, I think there's new kind of emerging ideas as well, which extend the social understanding of it. So as I mentioned earlier, we've focused a lot on, like, frustrated psychological needs, but there's actually stuff moving into how social norms influence this now. So this is the idea that if I perceive people around me as, for example, going to get the vaccine, I'm also more likely to get the vaccine myself, because that social norm is, you know, how you accept reality. It's this emotional gateway into believing reality. There's also the element of like, if you communicate to someone that there's really strong scientific consensus on a subject, specifically climate change, usually that's also a gateway to changing your beliefs to be more in support of these scientific concepts, or yet to believe that there's the science is sound on, for example, that climate change is happening. What I mean there is that it's not just about our own kind of individual psychological processes. It's also about our perceptions of the world around us and what others are doing, whether we're close to these people, that kind of thing. And we identify with these people as well.
Mm-hmm.
Crosses over, I guess. Yeah.
So this may be a difficult question for you to answer. Mm-hmm. As I was prepping for this flex season, the literature that has come out in the last 2 years in conspiracy theories has exploded. It's moving very, very quickly. But for our audience is directed at undergraduates in psychology who may or may not be looking towards graduate school and getting their own PhDs. If they were interested in conspiracy beliefs and studying conspiracy theories, what do you think their dissertations will look like in 5 years?
Nice, okay. That's a difficult one. I think actually, There's a lack of research on the top-down processes, I think. So this is stuff like how we consume media, right, or digital media, or our skills that we have to discern the difference between real and fake news on different types of digital media. So as I kind of mentioned, you know, we know a fair amount now about these psychological processes. But yeah, I think those kind of the ways that society is structured and the ways that media is structured, or and how we've grown up around those in different ways, or how we interact with those pieces of media, I think will be a really good and also prevalent area of research in the future, definitely, especially as people now are coming through with more experience in using these types of new digital media and stuff. I mean, I'm not so old myself, but I kind of grew up more with Facebook as a digital media thing, whereas it tends to be more now things like TikTok and Instagram and things which I'm not as tuned into intuitively, right? So I think that will really influence the literature in that way, in an exciting way, I think. Make me feel like a boomer, basically. Moving forward. Which is a good thing, I should say.
And then my last question is, what is your favorite conspiracy?
It changes, but I think the Epstein one, definitely. I think,
same.
Yeah. the fact that it's actually, yeah, I've got a embroidered sign.
Oh, like, cute.
Which is Epstein didn't kill himself. Yeah. But I think it's, you know, I'm not saying that I fully believe this, by the way, but it's one of those ones where you can just completely understand, right? Exactly. It's very compelling. But also this classic story of paedophile elites is like,
right,
something that's been around for a long time. It's not a new conspiracy theory. It's often from the satanic panic stuff, right? Where it was about sacrificing children. But I think it's just really come into its own unfortunately, in a way, you know, with this whole thing that there genuinely was this very connected paedophile who was, you know, sex trafficking people and stuff, and that's just really fits the narrative very well. So it's kind of, I can understand why a lot of maybe existing conspiracy theorists have had their concerns feeling like they're justified, you know, or yeah, confirmed, I guess I should say.
And it's like we were talking about, I feel like the Epstein conspiracy reaches across several different clusters. Mm-hmm. Right, so like you get your British royalty conspiracy theorists get roped in, your anti-Trumpers get roped in, your anti-Democrats get roped in,
your anti-Semites as well. You've got Mossad involved. I'm pretty sure it's based on very shoddy evidence that Mossad was involved or is linked, but so I'm sure it's just anti-Semitic, you know, from the base kind of thing. But either way, you know, that context is, yeah, there's always anti-Semitism in conspiracy theories. For some reason, it's the the most prevalent one.
So very, I'm with you on that one. It's highly, I will indulge my entertainment with this one for right.
Yeah, I was gonna say, yeah, the gateways happen now. Yeah, we're all radicalizing each other just from chatting to each other.
Oh man.
Don't fight it.
Keep our theme for this little flex course. We have this really big list of biases. Mm-hmm. And every week, and we're slowly getting through them, but we're about halfway through. Every week I pick a bias and I try to relate it to what we're talking about. But I think this one will fit. So our bias of the week is The Bias Blind Spot. So Cronin and Kugler, 2007. It's a tendency to see oneself as less biased than other people or be able to identify more cognitive biases in others than in oneself. Mm-hmm. So if we're talking about understanding conspiracy theorists, they're more biased than we are. They don't understand the world we do. And they're going to look at us and go, you guys don't understand the world. You need to go and like watch this YouTube video, read this Facebook article, then you'll understand what's going on.
Yeah, it'll fix your thinking. I think that's a really good bias actually to think up, because not only, you know, I think with conspiracy beliefs that it seems to be these multiple biases interacting, right? You're kind of using these availability heuristics of the most available information at the time, but by doing that you're also jumping to conclusions. That's like jumping to conclusion bias. Also the conjunction fallacy, thinking that, you know, two things happening is more likely than one thing happening on its own. But all of these are happening, you know, at once. So I think that kind of meta bias thing, again, I guess I could call it, is the perception of your own biases, I think, is a really interesting one. And maybe what I can relate to that is, again, what I mentioned earlier about the need for uniqueness, you know, that can sometimes encompass this overestimation of your own intelligence. And it also fits into these kind of narcissistic tendencies as well, that sometimes this defensive self-esteem response that conspiracy believers can have, where they're accusing everyone else of conspiring against them, right? Because they can never be wrong. They've never done anything wrong themselves. So negative circumstances are everyone else's fault. That's kind of an overestimation of your abilities, right? Maybe a superficial one, but it's definitely there. So yeah, I think that bias is a great one to bring in. That being said, yeah, I think we all have that bias in a way as well. We have all biases, don't we? But that's a really, really dangerous one. Yeah. I'm a robot, a cyborg.
I see all.
Exactly.
And it's definitely a point of like you had mentioned, sort of living kind of within that almost like ambiguous sense of what's going on, is trying to keep open and not necessarily having that one answer. And then so, you know, that need for closure is good, and we like that reduction of uncertainty, but there's just something about social psychology, I think, that helps to prime us for that. That the more and more you study it, the more like, oh, this is complex. There's like six different answers as to why someone could do this or why we could see this happening. And maybe that helps to, I mean, then again, I'm saying that like, oh, it helps to reduce my biases, but that's bias blind spot. Like I'm seeing myself as less biased than other people because I know myself.
Yeah, ironically, you brought up more ambiguity while saying that you're happy with ambiguity.
Right.
As well.
Right. So,
yeah, I feel like this could go on forever in the meta thing. But yeah, I definitely agree with that. I think there's a trap to fall into, which is that I think I find myself falling into as well, which I think I get, ironically, some closure from ambiguity as well. You know, it's like people saying, yeah, but was it this or was it that? And my closure is exactly, you know, and it's like, that's not a fun person to talk to in that moment, you know, because it's like just really, superficial as an answer, you know. It's so I think what I mean by that is that I have, it's still a bias, you know. It's just that it can help, as you're describing, in terms of things like social psychology, where you kind of do tend to at least reflect like more on it, you know, and just make sure, but I think I've got the answer, but what else is there, you know? But that being said, you know, I think the approach to, I think they call it is it meta research, where they look at how we, you know, do our research, right? And whether that's an effective way to approach things, or how to define a theory, or how to analyze data, this kind of stuff. I think, you know, I genuinely believe in all of the replication crisis issues and all that stuff, you know, but I think there is something to be said about sociology and psychology in general, where there is this reflection going on. And that doesn't mean that the issues are fixed and stuff, but I think it's a good culture to create, right? Which is us to be constantly checking whether, or criticizing, you know, the pitfalls of our research. We can never be perfect, but there's a culture around it. And I don't really know much about other disciplines, but there is this impression I get from myself where I think they are hard sciences or something, you know, so therefore they probably don't have a replication crisis. Then I see this paper come out and I'm like, oh no, it looks like they have a replication crisis as well. So I think it's just spoken about loads with psychology, and I quite like that, you know. I like being the bullseye or whatever for the replication thing, because it creates that
constantly
culture, yeah.
Questioning.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Phrase of the week. Yeah, that.
That's something that we trace quite a bit in this podcast, is kind of this like underlying anxiety within psychology to like, we are a science, but also it's okay that we're not with the other natural sciences, but we're still a science. but we're not with them, but it's okay. But we should be with them, but we're not with them, but that's okay too. And so like the replication crisis and like that conversation, I feel like also kind of like arises out of like, we have to constantly be watching ourselves. Yeah, it's like this self-surveillance within the field, which you have to be cool with if you want to get into it.
Exactly, exactly. Which again, falls back into this, right? This ambiguity, this, yeah, creating a culture of being okay with that. I think, yeah, it's definitely part of that.
Or you can delve into my new favorite conspiracy theory, that it's the big hard sciences that are holding us down. It's a secret cabal of chemists, physicists, and biologists who are keeping psychologists from getting ahead.
The science jocks, yeah, yeah. I like that one. Just start sharing that on the internet. We'll make some memes and spread it.
There we go.
That'll be my profile gif for this episode.
Yeah, I can't say I'm going to share that. Sorry, but yeah. Good luck with it.
So, I guess to end up, thank you for joining us. This was a fantastic conversation. So awesome to delve into this. This is kind of like tangentially on my radar. I want to get into it more. I've tried and failed, because when you ask a bunch of undergraduate students, do you think that like if the government is monitoring our actions, they're like, yes, it absolutely is. We know this.
You're insane, of course they are.
Yeah, I need to rethink my conspiracy theory, this conspiracy theory scales that I'm using, and then the approaches that I've been going with.
Well, you know, so the fact that it's real, although it kind of falls into this like weird category, doesn't make it not a conspiracy, of course, and even a conspiracy theory, because if it's not completely proven, then you can't say it's true, right? Or
how much
yeah, exactly is the degree of it, right? And yeah, we recently used surveillance as an example in one of our papers recently, and the reviewers understandably had these concerns about, they're like, is this really a conspiracy? And we're saying, well, the idea is that they are secretly colluding without the consent of the public. Like, that's definitely the definition of a conspiracy. Whether it's a conspiracy theory is the difficult part, right? Because yeah, is there enough evidence to say, you know, it's a supported hypothesis or whatever you want to call it? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But no, yeah, thank you so much for having me on as well, I should say. And I've really enjoyed this conversation. Yeah, always some really interesting stuff comes up. This is definitely one of the most fruitful chats that I've had about this stuff. Yeah, you guys are clearly very genuinely interested in this topic. It's great.
Thank you.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you.
So with that, we'll bid our listeners adieu. Bye, everybody.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.